Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay.
I'm not wearing a protective flu mask, Bob. I have one.
That's unlike you not to be wearing
one. I'm not wearing it because it would reinforce this annoying stereotype cliche you have that I am somehow a hypochondriac.
It had kind of occurred to me that the swine flu thing combined your two worst nightmares, a deadly virus and an irredentist people to the south, yeah.
Not to mention world government, but we'll get to that.
We'll get to world government later.
But allergies is what's bothering me. So there.
Well, as long as that's all it is, but how can you tell for sure, Mickey? Have you really thought adequately about the possibility that whatever you're feeling might actually be swine flu?
Yes. It's trees, Bob. Reagan was right. We've been through this before. Trees are the source of evil in the world.
Okay.
And I'm highly allergic to tree pollen, and they're all pollinating, so I'm in a really crappy mood.
Okay. Just seems to me you can't be too careful with these things, but it's up to you.
I know. Isn't it looking like the swine flu thing? I mean, it probably isn't overblown, but the latest I heard was that there were fewer cases than they feared.
I think maybe we should get ahead of the overblown meme curve and maybe declare it overblown, but that would be dangerous because then it might turn out to be much graver than anyone feared.
Yeah.
So let's not do that. Let's adopt a concerned skepticism.
You're strategizing on the basis of appearances as usual.
I'm sorry. We shouldn't be joking. I mean, this is, you know, people. But you know what I was shocked to find out is how many Americans die of the flu every year. You know what that number is?
36,000.
You got it. I knew I could count on you to have that number at your fingertips. So you read that New York Times op-ed, too.
Yeah, I think Brian Williams said it on NBC. That's how I saw it.
Well, I know where he got it. But then the puzzling thing is, do you remember the Hong Kong flu? I think I actually had the Hong Kong flu in 1968. It ruined my Christmas, I think, when I was like 11 or 12. And do you know how many people died of that?
Many, many, many.
No, 35,000. So
really?
Why was that such a big deal?
Oh, I thought that was hundreds of thousands.
According to the same New York Times op-ed, that was 35, and its typical year is 36.
The answer, which I think Robert Bazell gave to Brian Williams, is these are healthy young people who are dying, as opposed to old people who already have respiratory problems. And it's much more troubling when healthy young people are dying, because that's not sort of the natural cycle, and B, because it's a harbinger that it's a really strong virus and could spread.
It's true that most of these 36,000 every year, I think, are probably either elderly or very young. Now, is it the case that in Mexico, it's very much kind of typical, age-typical, like young and medium-aged people who are dying from it?
That's my impression. We're talking about things that I don't know about.
But yeah, well, it seems to me that's a very important question, because one theory thrown out as to why people in Mexico are dying and the only person in America to die is Mexican, I gather, ethnically, is that one of the theories is that there is some ethnic vulnerability, and I guess so far this is consistent with that. But another of the theories is that way, way, way more people actually have it in Mexico then we realize, so that actually the percentage of those who have it who are dying is really not all that high. But
yeah,
I think if that's the case, then there would be the age would be skewed toward older people and very young people, right? Does that make sense or not? It may not, so never mind.
But my impression is that like 25-year-olds are dying of it, so.
Okay, well that was my question, but then you professed ignorance. But
right,
that's
just what I was told by Robert Bazell.
Well, he does this for a living. He's a professional. You can trust him.
Okay, well, there you go. The role of ethnic vulnerabilities is interesting. Have they ever solved the paradox of why people in Africa get AIDS heterosexually and in the United States they don't seem to?
I don't know. There is, though, viruses adapt very quickly to their environment, and I don't know if this is related, but it is the case that the AIDS virus, in areas where there's a lot of promiscuity, leaving aside for now the heterosexual-homosexual distinction, when transmission for the virus is relatively easy because of the rate at which people have sex, then the virus tends to be more lethal. I think I've talked with you about this. Because in those cases, because to the extent that transmission to another person is easy, then the virus can afford to kill its host without compromising its own virulence, right?
Interesting. So I don't think we have talked about that.
Well, it's a fact that with AIDS, I think maybe this is not relevant to the flu, because with the flu, unlike with AIDS, you're only infectious for a very small amount of time anyway, right? Yeah. So you're going to be, your utility to the virus is going to end very soon, whether
right.
you die or not.
Right.
But in the case of AIDS, it's true that that there was a correlation between the lethality of the virus and the promiscuousness of the environment, and that was due to the evolution of the virus. Now, whether that's related to the question you just brought up, I don't know.
That sounds more like a point I heard Malcolm Gladwell make at some point. But
well, you know what? If you had been going to the conferences I was going to, like many, many years ago, you would have heard it. You
yeah.
would have heard it there too.
Yeah. Well, this is supposed to be mindless banter, and you've
I think we're doing pretty well.
Such an issue
so
about
far,
which we know nothing.
So far, it's almost completely data free. I think we can do an hour.
36,000. That's a datum.
No, you're right. You're right.
So, what do you want to talk about first?
Well, I guess we've done swine flu, huh?
No, we haven't. Let's just keep going with that.
Yeah. Do we have anything else to say, though?
Yes. You think it requires world government, and you wanted to rebut this actually pretty good David Brooks op-ed.
Thought Brooks's op-ed was good?
Well, at first I thought he's never going to pull this off. Obviously. A global pandemic demands a global government to deal with it. And by the end, I thought he'd argued the case at least to 50-50. And the arguments that make sense to me are two things. First...
Well, wait, can we first tell people kind of what the argument is? I mean...
Go ahead.
It is... And it seems to be a little odd. I mean, maybe it's like a neocon thing or something, that both David Brooks and Applebaum of Slate took the occasion of this virus to raise an issue that nobody had brought up. I mean, it's like nobody was saying we need a stronger WHO, but they took the opportunity to kind of share their fears about the potential of the WHO to do damage so anyway, Brooks was arguing that the WHO shouldn't get any stronger than it is, even though he didn't have any complaints about the way it's functioning now. And now, sorry, proceed with your critique.
Now, what did Ann Applebaum say?
Ann Applebaum's was, I thought, a little weirder. It was like, well, we have the WHO's doing fine, and it's because we have a good director of the WHO, but we're just lucky, because often they've had terrible directors, and... They're often, the WHO is often trying to do, I've got a quote from it here, stuff it shouldn't be doing, for example, a large chunk of money is devoted every year to tackling the social and economic factors that determine people's opportunities for health, such as poverty, education, and climate change. All worthy issues, et cetera, but seem well beyond the scope of an organization that should primarily be concerned with infectious disease. Then she miraculously drags in that conference on racism, which has nothing to do with the WHO, but it has to do with multilateralism. I don't know.
Why isn't there a good point that the WHO has been dragged into fashionable causes that have nothing to do with its mission and that are a potential black hole for billions of dollars?
Well, first of all, I would say that whether poverty... cases where poverty is makes you vulnerable to disease is not irrelevant to a body that treats contagious disease, okay? But I also just thought it was kind of, in both cases, I thought it was kind of odd that they pulled this thing out of left field. I mean, you've got an institution that's functioning totally to the satisfaction of David Brooks, and he warns against its dangers, and... you've got to, and there's just kind of a similar thing here where, I don't know.
It's an argument of timing, whether or not the arguments are right. They should have waited to a more appropriate time.
Seems to me that it betrays an inordinate fear of global governance.
I think they fear global government. I don't think they're making any bones about that. And they're allergic to it. When they catch a faint whiff of it, they fire off all barrels. So that's what they're doing. But that doesn't—that has nothing to do with whether their arguments are good or not.
You're quite right. So let's proceed to the merits of David Brooks's arguments. What part did you think he got right?
Well, he argues
the parts of this isn't his argument. My argument is first. There's a democratic argument. I feel I have some, as a citizen of the United States who has access to email and things, that I have some influence over the United States government. I voted for Obama. I can email somebody who can email Obama. There are a lot of people who are like that. I have no democratic investment in world government. First, it's way too remote. Things.
Well, if it depends on the body.
The actual mechanism is undemocratic. Because all sorts of governments that aren't democratic have say in it. And the second argument would be because of that, and Brooks does make this argument, it's sort of inherently slow. I mean, you got to get Robert Mugabe to go along with whatever initiative you're planning, and that's the current response of country by country has actually been fairly quick. So why count on the slothful global agencies when you don't need them?
Well, first of all, nobody I know is arguing that you should, okay? It's a total straw man he's constructed. I haven't heard anybody say the WHO should be handling this stuff national governments are handling. So
this is a general argument against global government. You wrote a whole book about how humanity is teleologically tending toward global government. You can't back off that now, buddy.
Well, I can point out that in the book, nowhere do I say, and the WHO is woefully understaffed or anything like that, or underpowered. But anyway, in response to what you said, you're right that one of his big criticisms is, he says it would be sluggish. The institution would have to poll its members, negotiate internal differences, and proceed, as all multinationals do, at the pace of the most recalcitrant stragglers, probably. Well, that's not an intrinsic property of all multilateral bodies. That's actually the way he wants it, okay? I mean, I would personally be happy to, say, in the case of the Security Council, replace the single nation veto with a dual nation veto, okay? But he wouldn't. So, I mean, you can't have it both ways, you know? I mean, you can't say, I don't want it to be more powerful, and the problem with it is it's not powerful enough. I mean, I'm happy. Does he want to, if he wants to make various bodies of global governance more powerful and more immediately responsive, and in at least some cases he'd have my vote, but I don't think he wants to. It's just like these people who, and this is actually classic neocon talk too, is to complain that the Security Council is always gridlocked and it's hamstrung. But they're the ones who want to hang on to the single nation veto and keep it gridlocked and hamstrung. It would still
be gridlocked and hamstrung. I mean, it's a legitimate argument to say either we go all the way or we shouldn't go there. And it seems to me, if for an international body to not only be able to make a decision but enforce it, it has to be able to tell recalcitrant governments, no, you're going to do it our way, and enforce that. And that requires some sort of international military and police force. And maybe he could say, well, we don't want to go all that way, so we shouldn't even go one step in that direction.
Why, that's a perfectly legitimate argument. It doesn't in all cases require an international military force.
We decide everybody has to vaccinate. Putin says, no, I'm not going to vaccinate. What happens?
Well, it depends on what you had set up. It could be that there are economic sanctions that ensue down the road or something. I don't think anybody's... First of all, again, nobody's raising this idea.
Sanctions. Yeah, that'll act in time.
Well, no, it wouldn't act in time. It would just be a price that was paid. I mean, nobody... Again, this gets to the point that nobody's suggesting this. You and David Brooks are together dreaming up black helicopter scheme to argue about. Nobody's suggesting it, Mickey.
That's not true. You're saying, a dual nation veto will solve the problem, and I'll say, no, it won't. because you don't have any way to force governments to go along with what the dual nation veto doesn't veto.
Actually, in the case of the Security Council...
If you want to act fast, you have to do X, Y, and Z, and we don't want X, Y, and Z. It's a perfectly legitimate argument.
In the case of the Security Council, you actually do have ways to compel things, but that's a different realm of action. That's not like contagions, okay? Because you can authorize invasions.
So we're going to invade Russia when they refuse to vaccinate.
Mickey, I don't think you've been listening to me. I just said this is not relevant to contagions.
Okay, well, then what is relevant to contagion? The Brooks's point is your solution to get the
body
to act fast.
It's not my solution. It's nobody's solution.
Your solution is end the single...
It's totally fake thing.
Your solution is end the single nation veto, and his side would say, no, that won't do the job. Why is that not a legitimate argument? It won't do the job. It won't get the United Nations acting any fast enough. You need other things, and we don't want those other things.
That's my point. You do not want an effective body. I understand that. He does not want an effective body. I understand that. But you can't complain that it's not effective and then favor all the crippling, hamstringing, strictures that keep it from being effective. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not even saying I'm against world government. I'm saying you're trying to dismiss the guy out of the box because he's some kind of hypocrite. And I'm saying he's not a hypocrite. He's saying we don't want the type of world government that would be required to make it effective. It's not something we want. And it seems to me you have to address that argument. You can't say, oh, but you're hamstringing the United Nations by denying the dual nation veto. The dual nation veto won't do the job, Bob.
I'm saying you can either say, I do not want this to be an effective and powerful body. Or you can say the trouble is that that we're not letting it, be effective and act powerfully. But I don't see how you can say both. That's all I'm saying. And it is common for neocons, again, leaving health issues aside, to point to the Security Council's impotence as reason to never take it seriously, and then to oppose any suggestion that we make it less impotent.
That seems to me a fair argument, but you cling to these little procedural reforms that are inadequate to solve the problem as if suddenly they were going to be effective. And it's a completely legitimate argument for Brooks to say, in order to make it work, we have to go whole hog, and we don't want to go whole hog, so I don't want to take a step down that road.
Okay,
why
but he
is that
did not
illegitimate?
Say that last part. If he said that last part, it would not be disingenuous. That's all I ask.
It's pretty clear that David Brooks does not want an international government with a global police force capable of enforcing its writ around the planet. I don't think he would deny that.
I would appreciate the full disclosure for the slower students like me who thought it was a little disingenuous here. But anyway, the other thing is, I mean, he says, look, the response has been adequate. Mexico did this, so-and-so did this, so-and-so did that. Not bad, nations acting on their own. And that's true, but on the other hand, I doubt the WHO would be stepping in and prohibiting them from, whatever, they're closing schools, taking all these domestic measures.
They might.
So I can't even summon the scenario he's arguing about to mind.
Let's talk about that. The Mexico decides it wants to stop, Europe decides it wants to stop flights to the United States, okay? The United States thinks that's an overreaction, it'll cripple the U.S. economy. We get the global government to say, Europe, you can't do this. There's your conflict.
Actually, I'm going to hear, it's characteristic, Mickey, of my integrity or something, that I'm about to mention something that's inconsistent with the argument I was just making, because I don't totally understand it, which is that in this very case, it's funny you should bring this up, but as I understand it, in this very case, the WHO said, in an advisory capacity, since it doesn't have the power, said, we don't think you should be restricting flights, and I think this was in response to the European proposal to restrict flights to North America, right? And I'm just taking time out to ask the question because I'm puzzled as to why the WHO did that. And I actually suspect that what you're seeing is the corruption of the WHO. I suspect that America pulled some strings to get the WHO to say that, because I don't see any way that follows from the mandate of the WHO. I can see the WTO saying that, you're getting in the way of commerce, but the WHO, what does it care if you overreact?
But any world government would have to balance the interests of the global economy and stopping the pandemic, and so you're saying the hypothetical that I hypothesized about is actually what's actually happened.
Except that it's a strictly advisory opinion, but I'm saying that is an example of the of the WHO not being global enough. In other words, again, like a number of supposedly global institutions, the U.S. has disproportionate influence, and I suspect that in this case it may have been a corrupting influence.
Well, but if you have a world government, it can't. It has to balance the interests of the entire planet. You can't have.
I don't want a world government, Mickey.
In America,
I never use the phrase world government.
In America,
I don't want one.
You can't have the EPA shutting down the auto industry while you're trying to bail out the auto industry. The government has to choose what the balance is. So if you have the United Nations, it has to say we can't have the WHO shutting down the world economy while we're trying to revive the world economy. You have to decide what the balance is. That's any responsible government will do that.
Sure. Whatever level government resides at, that's an issue, yeah.
So you can't complain that the WHO is corrupted because it takes these other interests into account.
Well, no, but I mean, it would not be the logical bureaucratic role of the WHO to worry about commerce being impeded. That's
right.
What's weird about this.
Well, somebody put pressure on them.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, if there was a more mature body of global governance, you would expect something like the WTO to be concerned about this. And this raises... you know, we were talking about whether this thing is overblown, but the way it may be underblown, it seems to me, is if you start getting interactions between the flu epidemic and the economic crisis, right? So that if people start taking measures in response to the flu epidemic that reinforce the downward spiral of the global economy, such as shutting off traffic to air traffic to nations, which might in some cases be a rational response on health grounds, that seems to me the total apocalypse, is if these two things start interacting with a kind of negative synergy.
I agree, although I don't quite see how the loop completes. In other words, the flu puts the world economy in the dumps, but how does that create more flu? It doesn't. It's not a vicious circle. It's a...
No, it reduces the amount of flu there would be. So it's not mutually reinforcing. It's just an unfortunate... I mean, the causality moves in one direction, and the combination of the two tracks is just highly unfortunate.
Right, it's a harmonic convergence of disaster, yes.
The
one point I wanted to make about this idea that I had the last time we talked, which was a global infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, my idea for globalism... The virtue of that is you could plan it well in advance. So even though these international institutions operate at incredibly slow speeds, eventually after a few years they would have a list of infrastructure projects that they could start, and then if there was a global recession, that all they would have to do is pull the trigger and start spending money and employing people. You know, all these other countries would have given the green light. It probably makes no sense at all, but...
Well, let me remind people what exactly you'd proposed, and I actually ridiculed it at the time, but I want to withdraw some of my ridicule.
That was just your general tendency to ridicule anything I say.
No, actually, I mean, that is my default mechanism, but there are exceptions. I can shut it off at will.
Go ahead.
So you had said, this was in the context of the G20, and I had said the problem is... we don't have a mechanism to coordinate fiscal policies in a global economic crisis. It would be good if we could coordinate stimulus packages among the affluent nations. You had said, hey, how about a global body that does the fiscal stimulus? And I laughed you, you know, kind of tried to laugh you off of the screen because I just imagine this thing, you know, this global body saying, okay, bridge reconstruction in Poughkeepsie, check, you know. But then I realized actually that it turned out something a little like that is evolving functionally. I mean, one thing that Obama did get done at the G20 thing is he got agreement to increase the resources that the IMF has to loan money, you know, to mainly poor nations. Okay, but it's a really substantial increase from something like 250. A billion to something close to a trillion, and then first of all, you know, that is a fiscal stimulus. I mean, if you give, it's a different mechanism from the one I had imagined. I had imagined, you know, when you brought it up, them okaying individual projects. This is rather giving nations the resources to spend money however they see fit within their own economies. And it is, of course, focused on the poor nations, but still, from a global perspective, during a downturn, it is a global mechanism for fiscal stimulus. And meanwhile, there was an article in the Washington Post I'll link to about how, in a lot of ways, here's the headline, Finance Chiefs Back a Bolder IMF, Bigger Role for Emerging Nations. And there's a few things that they're doing that are going to change the character of the institution. And it's just a reminder of how these institutions can evolve and wind up doing things they weren't especially originally intended to do. So I take back my ridicule.
The amount of money didn't seem to be all that impressive for the entire globe.
It's not massive. I mean, a trillion ain't nothing, even on a global level. But the main point is that I now see a mechanism by which the affluent nations could choose to inject money into the world economy in a collective, coordinated way without coordinating their individual national stimulus policies. And again, you know, the money would go mainly into poor nations, wouldn't as directly improve the economy of developed nations as an alternative approach might. But it would help. I mean, we are all in this together, you know. I mean,
I was being imperialist, but the virtue of focusing on particular projects is, you know, are we going to give Robert Mugabe $100 million to spend as he sees fit, or are we going to spend $100 million to improve water projects in Zimbabwe? I can get behind spending $100 million to improve the water projects a lot easier than I can giving some corrupt dictator a bunch of money to fritter away, even though that's stimulative too. But, you know, there's good stimulus and bad stimulus.
Two things. I mean, there's only two or three dictators in the world who are as bad as Mugabe, and A, and B, the IMF would always have the discretion just to give little or no money to the Mugabes of the world.
Right, but it just seems to, I don't know, maybe my idea doesn't work. The idea was that Mugabe would have signed off ahead of time for this project, and there's nothing he could do to stop it, but of course he could stop it.
I mean, this is a global governance that I would think conservatives should like, compared to the other forms, because it leaves decision-making at a relatively local level.
Well, but they used to like it because it would run around the world telling third-world countries how to structure their economies and make them more capitalist like us.
Right, and but the Post piece says that there's less of that now. Fewer constraints are coming with
right.
the money now.
Right. They're shoveling it out the door, yes.
Shoveling it out the door.
We're through with world government, and it seems like we've spent an hour on it, but we've only spent 27 minutes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the 100 days. What can be
more
exciting?
You're going to insist on continuing to say world government instead of global governance, is that right?
What, that's some, like, poll-tested euphemism you've come up with that goes down easier?
Focus-grouped it to death, man. Yep.
It's like calling tax increases adjustments?
Well, also, it does imply a certain amount of decentralization. I mean, the phrase world government, you know, scares even me. I mean, the idea of, like, one, you know, highly unified, tightly integrated, omnipotent ruler off in Belgium somewhere, no.
I think I'll still call it world government.
Thank you.
Okay.
So you know what occurred to me, Mickey? And I don't know if anyone else has realized this. Tell me whether I have a scoop or not. But I was looking at the calendar today, and I realized, I just happened to be, you know, counting the days, I realized it's been exactly 100 days since Obama's inauguration. And I was thinking, tell me if this is a crazy idea, but I was thinking that you and I, and maybe some other journalists and pundits, if they want to, but not if they don't, could, like, kind of size up, you know, the Obama presidency's, you know, first 100 days. What do you think?
Well, because there was that Roosevelt thing. You know, people made a big deal of that, so there's like a... You could compare him to Roosevelt.
That hadn't even occurred to me. That's great. Well, then we got to do this.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea.
Thank you.
Here's my line. Obama's... Everybody's hyping how radical and lefty Obama is. Nothing he's proposing is that radical. He said, you know, there was this New Republic cover story about how he's re-pledged to revive the Democrat idea of reversing income inequality or increasing income equality. Nothing he's done is going to do that. It's basically a bunch of little things plus national health care. This is an example of the thing that the New Republic said was going to help reverse income inequality.
Now, is this the Frank Foer, Noam Shriver piece?
Yes, but this is Shriver's response to my attack on him. Mm. Two more nudgeocracy ideas that Obama has signed onto with an idea toward reducing inequalities. More generous retirement savings incentive for working families, Bob. Families who currently make less than $50,000 are eligible for a refundable 50% tax credit up to $1,000 of savings. And Obama wants to raise the ceiling to $65,000. Now, that's going to reverse two decades of income inequality, raising the ceiling from $50,000 to $65,000 for a $500 tax credit for retirement savings. There you go. A radical
socialism presidency. Socialism.
So basically, you know, I thought he wasn't that radical until I read John Judas's article, which claims that after all the dust is settled, we're going to be spending 45% of our GDP on government. And so, you know, my line had always been, we're not going to be Sweden, we're not going to be France. They spend 45%, we spend 35%. For 45%, if we're really spending the same as Sweden, I want a cradle-to-grave welfare state. If we spend 45% and don't get that, it seems sort of a ripoff. If we spend 45% of GDP and we still have a survival of the fittest, rough-and-tumble capitalist economy, well, where the hell is that 45% going? I want Sweden if I'm going to spend that much money.
So then you have kind of your own little thesis. I mean, the 100-day assessment seemed to me kind of divided between, like, he's doing great, he's doing okay, and then the third is kind of the liberal overreach thesis, like Jonah Goldberg, Dick Morris wrote these columns saying, you know, in the long run he's dead, he's just trying to do too much. Your complaint is he at least this is you after reading Judas. Yes, he may be trying to do a lot, but he's not even going to deliver the goods for all the money he's spending.
He's not doing that much, but he's managing to pay a fortune for it, and that's a big problem.
Okay, well,
but I have no problem with what he's trying to do. So far,
Well, isn't a lot, I don't know, isn't some of that 45% calculation attributable to the stimulus bill?
Yes, and Judas is assuming, along with the right wing, that it's not going to go back down again.
Right.
And he seems to think it's a great triumph just to spend the money, regardless of whether we get anything for it. It's terrific if we're up there with Sweden at 45%. Well, I don't quite understand that.
Well, but, I mean, it seems to me in general, the liberal overreach thesis, and it was most fleshed out in Dick Morris's thing. Did you read that?
Yes.
You know, he went through and kind of listed all the stuff that you know, where he thinks Obama's going too far or gone too far. It seems like it's true that a lot of money has been spent. On the other hand, so much of it is attributable to this financial crisis, and in fact, much of it had been initiated under Bush. I mean, both the bank bailout and the auto bailout goes back to Bush, and moreover, any administration would have done some version of the bank bailout, I think, without a doubt. I think pretty much any administration would have done some version of a stimulus package.
Wait,
so,
go ahead. Yeah.
No. I mean, that's for starters. They're acting. You know. I mean, I think my point is kind of self-evident, right? I mean, it's clear. But it's a silly critique to make.
But the question is, what's the exit strategy? And with the stimulus package, it's one thing if you spend a bunch of money. It's another thing if you grow government in ways it will keep on sucking up money for the next generation. So if you hire a bunch of new civil servants who are never going to leave and are going to require pensions and the government's going to grow by 15, 25, 35,000 people, there's no exit strategy. You're going to be spending that money forever. So and the same with the auto bailout. If we go in and restructure the auto industry and then get out, that's one thing. If we have to keep subsidizing General Motors forever, there's no exit strategy.
Right. Now, in the stimulus package, I assume that a whole lot of these programs have finite lifetimes, and the concern is that once you start handing out the money, you know, you get the lobbying machine that keeps the money coming, right? I mean, it's not that a lot of this stuff doesn't have expiration dates, right?
It's more than that. It's once you hire a civil GS-15,
mm-hmm.
they never get fired, and that's much more, that's a much more rock-solid proposition than just, if you spend money on a consultant, the consultant will lobby for you to keep spending the money.
Yeah.
Occasionally we cut off money to consultants. Yeah. Very rarely do we actually successfully shrink the size of government.
Well, that probably is a challenge then, because we're talking, I mean, although, I mean, look, the bank thing is clearly finite, right? I mean, you know, in any scenario, either we go totally down the tubes or recovery eventually commences. So I don't think anybody imagines we're still pouring money into banks 2 years from now, okay? You know, the stimulus package may be more of a challenge. I also think the auto thing, you're almost already seeing it wind down as Obama is kind of steering them towards some kind of managed, in the case of Chrysler, he's orchestrating the deal with their the lenders. And in the case of GM, it may wind up just steering them toward bankruptcy, right? I mean,
well,
don't you?
It's weird. They have a proposed deal, which just came out yesterday, that the right wing is very upset about because it gives the UAW 40% stake of General Motors, and the government gets enough to make it over to be the controlling interest, and then the creditors only get 10%. And the right wing is saying, isn't this terrible that the UAW owns so much of General Motors? I think it's great that the UAW owns a lot of General Motors. You know, then they pay if they're inefficient work rules, they bear the brunt of the of not making money. They can go lower their own pay. They can go get rid of their own work rules. They have responsibility. They bear the consequences if the government doesn't keep pouring in money. The mm-hmm. problem is that government stake might lead the government to think, hey, we have to pour more money into protect our ownership stake. And then you violated the proposition you were just saying, which is the government doesn't get out.
Now, did it work that way with United Airlines? I genuinely don't remember. That is the one clear precedent, right, for workers becoming majority owners. But in that case, I think they were controlling owners, right?
There are a bunch of cases. There's Weirton Steel. There's, I think, Eastern Airlines was employee-owned. I think it's pretty much been failure after failure. I think Weirton Steel may still exist.
So are you saying that in this case the workers would be majority owners, but did you say who would be the controlling owner?
No, the government would be the controlling. The workers only have 40%.
Yeah, I'm not that enthusiastic about that remaining the case for really long.
The government or the workers?
The government. But then again, you know, I was not in favor of the whole auto bailout thing to begin with, especially.
I would just assume the UAW get 70%. I mean, then they have to raise money from all the potential creditors who don't want to give them money because they screwed the last round of creditors. Let them bear the brunt of their own mistakes.
Would you give the UAW controlling interest?
Doesn't bother me. I'm for worker ownership. Let the, you know, that's responsibility.
Okay. Well,
that
I
ends
think,
the
I think,
that dissolves the adversary relationship by making the workers owners. The revolution
would be complete. I would be in favor of that.
The problem is they'll probably fail and they'll all lose their jobs. But let them give it a shot. I'm very pessimistic about Chrysler. It seems hard to believe that a failing car company from Italy, who's historically failed to penetrate the U.S. market, is going to take over a failed car company in the United States, and also the Opel division of a failing General Motors, and somehow make it all work. Now maybe this guy's a genius and he can do that, but.
So this is what? What is it? Remind me. Fiat is going to take over Chrysler or what?
Yes. Fiat's going to.
Now, Opel was originally a European brand, right? But that was then
bought
by GM.
Right. General Motors bought, and now they want to unload. And Fiat's made talks about how they're going to acquire it, and they're going to strike some alliance with Chrysler. And it's all very impressive for a company that isn't in very good shape itself, Fiat.
Mm-hmm.
No, let them try. The key is that the government's got to stop giving money. I mean, I know you never wanted them to give the money in the first place, so we're approaching harmonic concord here. But as long as the government stops giving money, then they have to live with the cost of their own mistakes. And if they ask for too much, that's their problem.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that's the key. And it's an open question, as with so much of the Obama administration, whether he really is going to cut off the spigot or whether he sort of likes running General Motors and firing the CEO and wants to keep his hand in. There are all these things with the Obama administration where he seems reasonable, but behind the scenes there is the potential for a lot of politicized mischief with the census, with Acorn, with Wall Street. Now he controls a lot of banks because he gave them TARP funds, so they sort of have to do his bidding. There's an argument that that's why they came around in the case of the auto industry, because he control, you know, he has them by the short hairs with the TARP funds. And if you were a mischievous person, you could do a lot of damage having that much control. And the jury is still
I don't think he's mischievous. I mean, I think you have to have another scenario for me to get worried. Mischievous is not a word.
No, if you were, but if you establish the precedent that the government does this, then the next guy might be Rod Blagojevich, and then you're in deep trouble.
Yeah. Well, and this started in the Bush administration. I mean, they started playing kind of hardball with the banks. I mean, you know, back during the B of A thing.
If the next guy is Bush, you're worried. I mean, Bush does do that kind of politics. So.
Yeah. No, I'd like to get out of all of this stuff as soon as possible. But I just don't buy the critique of Obama that this is some extraordinary, act of socialist ambition to do these various things in response to the economic crisis.
You
are more or less what any president would have done.
You are against the auto bailout. How can you say that?
Well, I still think.
How can you say that? I'm against the auto bailout, but I don't like the criticism of the auto bailout.
Bush started it. I'm just saying this is not the idea that this is an especially left-wing act. This is Bush started that. Bush started the banks. Most presidents would probably do it. Last time Chrysler got into trouble, we bailed them out, like 20 years ago. It happens in politics. I'm just saying this doesn't seem to me, you know, any kind of special indictment of Obama that he did what most presidents would do. I wish he hadn't gotten so deeply into the auto.
Why? I also
will say, as long as you want my criticism, I will say, although I think on balance I'm giving him good grades for the first 100 days, I don't think the stimulus package will be judged favorably by historians, because it was so rushed to seize the moment that it has what in retrospect will seem to be clear deficiencies, one of which emerged in a Blogging Heads dialogue I wasn't part of, that, you know, like they just relied on the formulas for allocating money among the states that had been written into pre-existing legislation. So like in the case of highway funds, they paid no attention to how badly a given state needs the money. So unemployment rate of different states doesn't figure in at all. It's like how many miles of highway you have. And I think clearly, ideally, you would pay attention to which parts of the country are hardest hit if it's a stimulus package, right?
But historians aren't going to condemn the stimulus package because it misallocated highway funds to Mississippi that should have gone to New York.
Okay, I've got another one in.
Okay.
High-speed rail. I may be wrong, but as I understand it, I only discovered this a few days ago, much to my disappointment. I think that with these various high-speed rail projects, they're going to basically just replicate the Acela. Is that right?
I mean, there's no real high-speed rail. That would cost
right. The Acela sucks. I mean, you know, the problem with the Acela was they realized that to have true high-speed rail, they'd have to change the gauge of the railroad tracks. They didn't have the money or patience or something to do that. So they came up with this thing that takes you like, you know, 1.5% faster and vibrates more. So, you know,
there's got to be a lot of that. Yes.
Well, that is a shame to go around implementing, you know, but there you see the trade-off. If you had to go back to the drawing board and say, well, we need new gauge railroad tracks, then it would kick in too late to be a stimulus.
Well, it's the same with his battle against inequality. He's got to make it 1.5% better. Or 1.5% less bad than it would have been without it, and he's going to call it a victory.
Yeah,
I sense a pattern.
And what about the critiques on the foreign policy front? You're giving him what are you giving him for the first 100 days?
God, I had no thoughts on that. It all depends on whether you think the Afghanistan war is a good thing to invest in, and I think the jury is out.
Man, that's a mess.
So,
I mean, he's taking a lot of flack for stuff like, you know, smiling when he shakes Hugo Chavez's hand.
Oh, who cares about that?
You know, that's funny. When I first saw that, I thought, oh, no, this is a classic Republican talking point. But then it seemed to me there wasn't that much blowback from that, right? And I think part of it is just people are just sick of this Bush mentality of, like, you know, if you get seen within a mile of any of our enemies, you know, you're a traitor. I just think a lot of people have consciously or unconsciously just kind of rejected that whole way of thinking, and Republicans are still trying to get mileage out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's apologized a little too much for my taste, but
and actually
doesn't
one
really bother me.
one quick analytical point about Chavez is the right-wing critique is, well, he's a horrible dictator and you grant him legitimacy and let him get away with more horrible dictation, you know. And, you know, in other words, the photo op grants him legitimacy. Well, I mean, Hugo Chavez, that's one kind of legitimacy he has. The kind he's mostly gotten in his country, he's gotten legitimacy from the opposite, which is belligerent nationalism, which involves dissing the U.S. and trying to thwart our aims. So it seems to me not crazy to give him a little taste of the kind of legitimacy you would like him to get addicted to, right? Yeah. You would like him to start deriving support domestically from the fact that he's on good terms with the United States. It seems to me not at all crazy to use that to try to wean him from the other legitimacy.
Right, and it seems to me he's a bit of a cheap date. You smile and shake his hands, and he's sort of all blown over.
And he gives you a free book right away.
Yeah, absolutely. It's better than Amazon. One thing I wanted to talk about was getting back to the auto bailout. I think I know the reason why you opposed it, because it somehow violated the free trade rules, because we're subsidizing our auto industry in a way that we wouldn't want France or Japan to subsidize their auto industry.
I may have brought that up, but I remember, my so-called opposition was actually kind of slow to emerge. I just never embraced it, and I kept raising doubts, and I guess now I'm actually against it. But I did think the downside of not intervening was being massively exaggerated.
Yeah. If you look at the number of GM employees, it's pathetically small compared to the way
it used to be. I made that point to you. I said, how many people are really talking to? And this is early on in this whole thing.
I guess
months
a lot of it's been farmed out to parts suppliers, so that's a deceptively small number who are actually assembling the cars. But still, I'm still for the bailout. I just think I was shocked by how, you know, that it wasn't 500,000 people working for General Motors. It was more, you know, way like a tenth of that or something.
But
I deny that you were slow to oppose the bailout. The New York Times put our debate right on their damn webpage as a debate because you were so strongly opposed, I think.
Okay, I'm happy to be on record as being opposed early, because I definitely oppose it now.
Okay.
I mean, it's just going to lead to bankruptcy, which is what people said we had to avoid at all costs via the bailout to begin with. So I don't know.
I think one argument is if it had gone bankrupt 6 months ago, then it would have really started a death spiral for the economy. Now you could go bankrupt and less of a problem.
I think business has been about as bad for GM as it could possibly be. It's hard to imagine early bankruptcy having. If anything, they'd be in better shape now. But I never.
It's weird. I was talking to a radio show host the other day.
Mm-hmm. And were you on the show?
No. There's tremendous pressure on radio shows for them to have product placement. Mm-hmm. So Rush Limbaugh is pushing the Chevy Malibu now, which is the only good car General Motors makes.
Yeah.
So I think maybe we should, at Blogging Heads, start some sort of similar thing.
Do you have any products in mind? Are you showing us any in front of the camera?
No,
right
I'm
now?
Not. I'm not. I'm looking around for any products I have.
One possibility is Nabisco bite-sized shredded wheat, because, you know, unbeknownst to you, you know, I do these comments monovlogs every once in a while since you refuse to have anything to do with our commenters.
Right.
And I've several times shown Fraser, the cutest dog in the world, eating a piece of bite-sized shredded wheat. Most recently, in a monovlog that we posted only a few days ago and to which we will link, right now only insiders know about it via the forum, but now that I've broadcast it, it's a global phenomenon. But anyway, I'm thinking Nabisco money for that.
That's good. I noticed you're getting some Hugh Downs money on Blogging Heads. I saw an ad.
Classy ads, huh?
It's pretty classy. I you know, if I were a hypochondriac, it's the sort of thing I would be interested in, but...
Yeah. Oh, we're getting a lot of SEIU ads, too, you'll be sorry to hear.
Is that really, for sure?
Yeah. But it's funny. Now, this is a good transition, because now, come to think of it, I think they're anti-Arlen Specter ads. I forget what it is they're trying to talk him out. They're trying to rally... Oh, it must be on Card Check.
Yeah, that's their big thing.
Yeah, okay, so... Yeah, but now he's a Democrat and presumably can vote for Card Check, right?
Well, that's a big issue. He said in his very statement where he announced that he was becoming a Democrat, my position on Card Check hasn't changed. So that suggests, if you were literal about it, that not only is he still opposed to Card Check, but he will still vote against cloture, which is the key vote. He could say, well, my position on carjacking is I'm still opposed, but hey, I'm voting for cloture. But he the emphasis seems to suggest that he was staying put. But of course, there's tremendous hope in the labor movement that he will come around. Either there'll be some cosmetic change and he'll declare he's for carjack, or the economy will improve and he'll declare he's for carjack, or he'll craft some sort of compromise that still helps labor and help push it through. So,
no, it seems obvious to me what he'll do. He will not join the Republicans in stopping it from coming to a vote, and then he'll vote against it. But it'll still pass.
Well, that assumes that nobody else will. It assumes it has the 60 votes necessary to get cloture, and it seems to me there are a bunch of Democrats. It's not just Spector who's holding up the bill anymore. There's a whole bunch of Democrats who came out voicing doubt.
Okay, but they don't need his vote for the bill per se. They just need his vote on cloture, and he will give the Democrats that, I'll bet you anything.
Well, it depends what the bill is. I actually think for the full force Karczyk bill, they might have trouble getting a majority. But that's not his problem. They could get a majority, and it's certainly a big blow in favor of Karczyk. And some of the websites were ridiculing Andy Stern, the head of the SEIU, your new paymaster, Bob, for saying, well, he had some hopes that Spector would come around. And they said, well, Andy Stern's you know smoking something here. He's obviously living in Fantasyland. It turned out he wasn't living in Fantasyland. He actually knew something about what he was talking about. So, on the other hand, a bunch of left-wing groups are saying, oh, don't worry about Karczyk. It's not going to happen. You're being paranoid. It's just being used by business lobbyists to scare business into paying them fees to lobby Congress. It doesn't have the votes. Well, they were obviously wrong, too. Business has every reason to be scared. And it's not just a creation of greedy business lobbyists to try to scare business. Something very bad for business might actually happen.
Okay. So you would be against. I can put you firmly in the against Karczyk camp.
Yes. The weird thing is it totally changes labor relations in a way that isn't realized. You know, traditionally. Did we talk about this before? Traditionally, unions would go, if unions didn't like what management was doing, they'd go on strike, and they'd have a strike, and there'd be picket lines, and people would try to cross the picket lines, and they would rally for public support, and one side would win, and one side would lose, and they would come to some sort of deal. With Karczyk, that sort of doesn't happen. The union just waits out 120 days, a government bureaucrat comes in, and awards them all a raise. It's like a union becomes a ticket to have a mediator come in and give you a 10% raise. So it sort of eliminates the whole crucial mechanism of the old labor laws and substitutes a new mechanism that is in some ways better. There are no strikes. And in some ways worse, it's incredibly bureaucratic.
But something I don't understand here, why are there no strikes? I mean, I thought Karczyk was just a way of getting a union at a company.
There are two parts of Karczyk. One is that it's a way of getting a union at a company. And two, it says right now if an employer is unionized, the employer said, well, I could always just not come to a deal. And they can't do anything because most of these unions do not have the power to punish an employer through a strike.
Mm-hmm.
If they do a strike, the employer will either wait it out or hire permanent replacements, or the union will just lose. So the union has given up on the strike power. Under Karczyk, the second part is a compulsory arbitration provision that says if they haven't reached an agreement after 120 days, I think it is, a government mediator will come and impose an agreement, a first agreement. The second agreement is up to them. But the first agreement is imposed by a government mediator. So that's, in some ways, more important even than them getting the union in the first place. It's that the union doesn't have to go out on strike. They can appeal to this mediator. And it's almost, it's impossible to conceive of a mediator actually lowering the wage. So the union basically has nothing to lose in terms of, like, looking like it got a wage increase. And mediators are known for splitting the difference, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, you know, one thing behind this, I think maybe that. Wait, tell me if I'm wrong. Is it the case that with a lot of kind of services unions, a strike is in a way a less plausible weapon than with? Is there something about the kinds of jobs we're talking about now that makes strike a less plausible weapon than they were back when it was overwhelmingly manufacturing?
Well, I'm sure that that's true, and the obvious reasons are that these are high turnover jobs, not jobs you have for life. So if you have a strike, half of your workers are going to go work somewhere else before the strike is over. But there may also be something about the sort of damage you can do. That I was trying to figure this out.
I think it's a more, it's almost too much damage, right? I mean,
if you strike the auto industry, you've crippled the entire Midwest. If you strike Staples, you've sent some, sent a bunch of business to Office Depot. But if you're Staples, it should be pretty damaging for you to send business to Office Depot. So a strike should be effective.
Yeah, I mean, I almost think sometimes it's more effective. I mean, what does Staples do? I guess the difference is I'm thinking Staples almost has to shut down, whereas GM, you know, can limp along with its production line temporarily out of commission. But
not anymore.
I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
so,
I tried to figure that out. And it turned out I didn't know what I was talking about either. But it's clear that unions have given up on the strike power. They've relied a lot on this, corporate, public challenges to corporations at stockholder meetings, public pressure, corporate campaigns. And mm-hmm. this bill would provide a new mechanism, which is mandatory arbitration. They wouldn't have to go on strike. They just make a case to an arbitrator, and they get awarded an increase.
Well, maybe the difference is the temp economy. I mean, so many people now are in kind of temp mode. You know, they can work on demand, they can work part-time, and in the services industries, they often don't have to be highly trained. So maybe strikes are more vulnerable to breaking now.
Well, strikes are definitely more vulnerable to breaking, but why are they more vulnerable to breaking in the service industry, aside from the fact that it's a high turnover industry? I don't know.
Well, no, but again, it's easier to train me to mop a floor than to make a car. And B, there's just, I think, more people poised to fill in for you temporarily because of the evolution of the temp economy.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But I was trying to think, was there something inherent in the actual product you're selling? And I couldn't come up with anything. But
okay.
Those reasons you gave are sufficient for it being very hard to organize strike in service industries.
So we've solved another problem.
I don't think so. We sucked up to your advertiser a little. That was good.
SEIU?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling you, the money's rolling in from those ads.
So I think we've done everything.
I think we have. I wanted to ask you something, Mickey, that I've kind of always wanted to ask you, but I've never been able to quite work up the courage.
Oh, Bob, okay.
Will you be my Facebook friend?
You're seriously asking that? I should have given up on Facebook. Of course,
you
I'll
have
be your friend.
Already. I
what
was
does
just
it do
about
for
to
me?
Get rolling on Facebook, but maybe you can talk me out of it. I looked at your site, and you got like a billion. You know, because you're one of these people who says anyone can view my friends, even if they're not my friend. I looked at your friends. You got a lot of friends.
That's not true, Bob. A, I don't proselytize. So I don't send out "Will you be my friend?" notices because I have such a fragile ego. If people don't say yes, I sulk for days.
So all those people came to you, Mickey?
Yes. And
whoa.
There are a lot of people there are a few people who send me friend things and I don't really know them, and I only really friend people who I actually know. There are various strategies, but it's not completely clear that there's anything one gets from going through the mental contortions that are required to decide who you want a friend, who you don't want a friend, how much privacy you want, how much privacy you don't want. I mean, eventually you come up with an alternative method to email people. Is what's wrong with the regular method of emailing people? The whole thing seems silly to me, and I have the world's most boring Facebook page to show for it.
Well, I've been trying to figure this out. I mean, I have a confession to make. I actually am on Facebook already, but I only have one friend, and it's been that way for several weeks
and
since
Fraser,
I joined.
Right?
What?
That's Fraser.
No, Fraser is my friend, but he's not my Facebook friend. Actually, he should have a page. That's a good point. I can get him an email address.
You could do that.
Now we're talking. But anyway, no. My friend is David Kirkpatrick, who is one of actually two journalists with that name. He's writing a book about Facebook. And he's the one who said, I said, should I be on Facebook? And he said, in the long run, you're going to have no choice or something like that. So I figured, well, he knows what he's talking about. So I think I'm going to dive in, but I mean, I think he thinks, and a lot of people think, particularly people in our line of work, should be on it. But it's still a little unclear to me how exactly to play it or what exact good it does.
Go ahead. People seem to feel it's good to promote your books, Bob, but you don't have a book coming out, so that doesn't matter for you.
You know, that reminds me. I actually have a book coming out, Mickey.
It's just a coincidence that you happen to sign up for Facebook right before you have a book coming out. Oh, my God.
It's almost eerie. You know, it reminds me of Jung's synchronicity concept, where two seemingly unrelated things will just turn out to have a hidden thing.
It's like when you hear a song on the radio and the announcer goes, and they'll be playing at Largo this weekend. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Kind of like that. No, but also, you know, I've always been very fond of people. I'm a people person. There's that.
The way you're well known as a gregarious backslider.
There's that, type. And then there is the book coming out. Yeah, that's true. I want to become a people person, and I thought maybe you could help me because I was impressed. You do have a lot of friends, Mickey. You got pages and pages, and you say you never say yes to somebody you don't know personally.
There has to be some sort of connection with them. Yeah. I don't have a lot of friends. I mean, Bob Hertzberg has like 5,000 friends. I have 160 or something. So.
Who's Bob Hertzberg? If he's got so many friends, how come I've never heard of him?
He's a local L.A. politician who apparently friends rather promiscuously.
So,
We're behind... Go ahead.
Yeah, well, now go ahead.
You're supposed to be talking about Twitter, not Facebook. Facebook is yesterday.
No, they're different. I mean, but here's the thing. If you're asking what can you do on Facebook... One thing you can do is broadcast slightly less obnoxiously than by email, right? I mean, if you were going to, as you know, some of our friends do, whom we won't mention, send out emails every time you publish an article.
I don't think that's obnoxious. Why is that obnoxious?
It's not obnoxious. Some people, it gets on their nerves. The tricky thing about it is if they use the same email address that they actually use to email you, then you can't say, you know, I don't want one of these a day and spam filter them because they might actually send you an email and then you would miss it, right? That seems to me a little sneaky. But anyway, with Facebook, there's none of that because you can say, don't show me this person's status updates, and you won't miss any actual targeted communication from them. And also, there's just a lower threshold for being annoyed on Facebook because the status updates are just, there's a torrent of them, right?
I'm much more annoyed by when somebody promotes their book on Facebook than if you send me an email saying, Mickey, my book's coming out. That'd be fun.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating.
They're perverting what's supposed to be a mechanism for social interaction into a commercial thing. Email is just like the public street. Everything goes on there.
You can also just start a site for your book, or you can start a fan site from yourself if your ego is quite that large.
Well, you could do that, Bob, and if one starts, we'll know who started it. No.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. You should do all those things, Bob. When people have a book coming out, they have to use every avenue.
Okay. So your policy would be then, with your Facebook thing, if somebody wanted to friend you and said, I'm a regular Blogging Heads viewer, you'd say no.
Sorry?
If somebody sent you a friend request and you didn't know them, but they said, I'm a regular Blogging Heads viewer and a fan of yours, you would say no.
If that's all there is, I tend to say no, yeah.
Wow. That's harsh, man.
Well, why do I want status updates from, like, a whole bunch of people who I don't know.
To using it, you know, I don't know. It depends on whether you want to use it for promotional purposes. Apparently you don't.
I guess if I had a book coming out, I might behave differently.
You might.
But
also, don't you feel a certain intimacy with the Blogging Heads viewers that you don't feel with just, you know, the average show?
Yes. If somebody comes up and says, I saw you on Blogging Heads, I think,
right,
my God,
like
this person invested actual time. And a shocking number of people, i.e. four, have done that to me recently. And I think, my God, this is a huge hit.
You mean the people who walk up to you on the street?
And remember things that I've said at Blogging Heads, or that you've said, yes. And we know who one of those is, Bob.
I'm not sure we do. Who?
Ann Coulter. But other people have... Our viewers and
our viewers.
And I'm shocked. If it's more than two, I'm shocked. So it is more than two. But not enough for me to friend them on Facebook. That's a big step.
Well, I guess I'm going to change my... right now, if you search for me, you won't find me unless you're my friend, and I only have one friend, so that kind of cuts down on the number of requests. But I guess I'll change that so that if you, Mickey, if you searched for me and searched for bloggingheads.tv, you would find me, and you could send me a friend request.
If I just type in Robert Wright, there'll be so many that I won't be able to...
Right. You would have to add bloggingheads.tv.
Okay. And, I'll do that, but you have to ask me, Bob. I might play hard to get.
I don't think I can do that, Mickey.
Bob.
Okay, I'll send you a friend request, and blogging his viewers should know that if they approach you, you will cruelly rebuff them, whereas I might not.
The point is that I don't think anybody actually is offended if they just say I'm a blogging his viewer and they don't get friended.
Okay.
Do you have some message to the to commenters? No.
Just to tell them that I did do a comments monovlog a couple days ago, and we can link to it. And there's two priceless Frasier segments. In fact, they're the main point of watching it. I'll send you personally. Maybe I'll put those up as dingalinks. It's Frasier before and after a haircut.
Why not?
Yeah.
And then, a few scantily clad women, and you'll be in business
in the dough.
You'll be in business with the SEIU.
So, I guess next time, Twitter, we're kind of out of time, and we've really illuminated this Facebook question.
we've
really gotten to the bottom of it. I think we agree that you should either use it or not.
You're
and
so behind.
Your friending policy could assume a number of forms.
You're so behind on Facebook. Leon Weaseltier is writing diarists commenting on 5,000-word Vanessa Gregoriadis articles on Facebook, and here we are having an inconclusive dialogue. I mean...
But I bet he's not on Facebook.
We got to get ahead of the curve.
Okay. Well, I'm on it. You can search.
Okay.
But I will friend you.
I look forward to it.
Okay. Next time.
Okay. See ya.
See ya.